Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
I know that face. It's Cooper. He's got you now.
Oh, we'll see.
If you wanna get down, I'ma show you the way. Boom. There it is. Let me hear you say,
Coop, there he is. Coop, there he is. Coop, there he is.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 487 for the week of November 27th, 2023. I am Moldy River Money David T. Cole, and I'm here with unindicted flight attendant Sarah D. Bunting.
Fresh in my drink, sir.
And Treasury Secretary Tara Ariano.
Dorothy Andrews, Elston Cabus at your service. Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week, for a very specific week, for Thanksgiving hangover week. We have had this topic in the can for at least a year, and it's finally time now that we are just past the 52nd anniversary to talk about Mr. D.B. Cooper, specifically about three scripted TV episodes which have very wildly different fictionalized takes on D.B. Cooper himself. Plus, we will have an interlude where Sarah is going to tell you about some of the best nonfiction D.B. Cooper sodes that you can also check out. So is everyone ready? Coop, here we are.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody got their D.B. Cooper diem?
Ooh.
I think because it's been 52 years, we should try to make this episode 52 minutes long. Exactly. See if we can do it.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Probably not.
I know. Well, it's down to you, Dave.
We're going to run down these episodes in reverse air order. So, Sarah, you are up first. Tell us what we are talking about to begin.
I would love to. We are talking about Leverage, Season 5, Episode 6, The D.B. Cooper Job. You'll just never guess what that episode is about. Running gags of a decade now, to the contrary. I don't actually care that obsessively about the D.B. Cooper case. But there is no denying that ever since a guy calling himself Dan Cooper hijacked a plane on Thanksgiving Eve of 1971, it has become a central preoccupation of pop culture. That's why we're looking at three different DB scripted takes today. Ordinarily, here is where I would run down the case file, but the first episode that we're talking about right now does that extremely economically for me, so let's do it. Clip one.
Before my father dies, help me do one thing for him. Help me bring D.B. Cooper to justice.
Wait, the number one unsolved mystery in the history of American crime, that's our new job?
No, our job is to take down Oliver Schmidt. This is just a detour, Sophie.
It's 1971, the day before Thanksgiving. A 727 takes off from Portland, bound for Seattle. It is hijacked by this man, a passenger who goes by the name of Dan Cooper.
Wait, I thought his name was D.B. Cooper.
That was misheard by a reporter at the scene, and then it was repeated until it became gospel.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Swoon, gone, swoon.
He shows the stewardess what appears to be a bomb. He demands $200,000 in cash and four parachutes. He gets them. Then he does something no one expects. Somewhere over the Cascades, which is near to where we are now, he jumps. And he disappears forever.
Sophie, just real quick. You had a poster of DB over your bed when you was like 15. Tell the truth, you did, didn't you?
So what? What if I did?
Wait, let me save us a little trouble here, okay? The guy jumped from 10,000 feet, yeah, but it was 7 below 0. He's in a 1971 parachute. He jumped in bad weather over dense woods. He didn't survive. Case closed.
You're right. This is probably just a, you know, waste of time.
Well, You'd think that, but Leverage is hotel TV. You don't expect a comparatively corny and cheap show like this to come up with this clever a solution, but I thought they did a nice job. I can run down the plot real quick and then we can discuss. Tara, you wanted to jump in?
Yes, before you do, I just wanted to say I thought his name was D.B. Cooper. No, that was misheard at the scene, blah, blah, blah. It's real, actually, they drank Flavor Aid energy of, correcting the record on true crime minutia.
It's D.B. Cooper's creature.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, proceed.
We prefer the term cryptids. Anyway, I think they did do a nice job. I reviewed this ages ago back when Best Evidence, my true crime review newsletter, was a podcast and that had a Patreon. And I talked a little bit about why, but I didn't want to get into too many spoilers, which we can definitely do today because come on. Long story, trying to be short, here's the deal. An FBI agent whose father worked/was preoccupied by the hijacking his entire career comes to the Leverage team hoping they can help crack the case before FBI Senior, played by Ronnie Cox, passes away of pancreatic cancer. Nathan Ford, that's Timothy Hutton, decides to take the job as a break from their season arc case, and he turns the logline over to Sophie, Gina Bellman, as we heard up top. The team dives into the case, which here means that we see extended flashbacks to key sequences reenacted many times elsewhere in film and television, but this time it's starring the Leveragers as various case figures. Hutton plays FBI Senior, Aldous Hodge and then Christian Kane are his FBI partners in the 70s, and Beth Riesgraf's Parker is a flight attendant based loosely on Tina Mucklow, the crew member who had the most extended contact with Cooper during the skyjacking. Kane's character in flashbacks, Steve Reynolds, was scuffling after returning from Vietnam. He was kind of given a hand up by FBI Senior. He ended up being a great undercover agent. We see a lot of completely unnecessary flashbacks that aren't costumed quite correctly, but whatever. He is played by Fred Ward in the present day timeline, and that also was not a great casting match, but the late Ward was always a gamer. Here he is dismissing a couple of the more popular theories about Cooper's real identity out of hand. Clip two.
My late wife was a stewardess on the plane.
Oh, wow. Well, then you're the right man to ask. It seems everyone has a theory about Cooper. What's yours?
About a year after Cooper vanished, Richard McCoy hijacks a plane out of Denver. Gets caught, sends the 45 years. Sometimes later, he makes a gun out of dental paste and breaks through the prison gates in a garbage truck. Dies in a gunfight with the FBI. There's a fellow in Florida, Dwayne Weber, admitted to being Cooper on his deathbed in 1995. You want a theory? Take your pick.
This, once again, is like a prophylactic, yeah, don't at us, which, yeah. Respect, I get it. So, after a few dead ends and the third act passing of FBI Senior and some heavy-handed parallels to the Odyssey to pad the runtime, Nathan has a breakthrough about that famous Identikit sketch and why it's wrong. And then it's time for a little talking villain action. Spoilers aho, fun ahoy, in case anyone actually wants to watch this. D.B. Cooper was Steve Reynolds all along. He stole the money so he could give it to his best friend Daniel Cooper's widow because Cooper got killed in Vietnam and Reynolds survived. Reynolds and the flight attendant, who ended up getting married, kind of accidentally conspired to throw the FBI off the trail with a description of the skyjacker that matched not the skyjacker, but the advertisement on the back page of the in-flight magazine. Reynolds is cuffed by FBI Junior, but then Nathan is like, well, FBI Senior isn't here to enjoy this, so maybe just let him go and let him be a legend. And of course, that's what happens. If you pull enough threads, it probably doesn't work. But I pulled a couple and it actually holds up pretty well for Leverage. Like, maybe I'm just grading it on a curve, but for a basic cable show like this, it's kind of shockingly elegant. What did you guys think?
I am embarrassed by how tickled I was by the Steve is D.B. Cooper twist. Mm-hmm. I just thought that was very clever. I mean, we heard a little bit in that clip too, the Catch Me If You Can knockoff score of this episode mm-hmm. too, which also one of my favorite movies, which also contributes to the
mine too.
He's a folk hero. We actually love D.B. Cooper. We think he's great. D.B. Cooper right. for president. In addition to which, and you didn't mention this, but the person playing D.B. Cooper/the star of the cigarette ad is Matt Nolan, who played Chucky, Steve's antagonist from season two of Beverly Hills 90210, who was on the show with Steve's mother. Yeah, I thought this was really charming. And at the end of it, like, you know, hotel TV for sure. I'm not going to seek out more episodes of Leverage, but this was so much better than the pilot that we watched for the canon. I enjoyed this immensely. Dave.
Well, first of all, just get out of my system. Leverage from a man animal.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was good. You're right. Much better than the episode we already watched last year for the canon. I thought this one was like just light, fun, airy, and you could tell it was written with no stakes. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't really matter to the show proper. So they're just having a good old time with it, and it really came through in the end product. And I do enjoy when shows can pull off actors not playing their original parts well.
Yep.
Sometimes it really doesn't work.
Yep.
But sometimes it hits. And I thought everybody was employed very well here. I did enjoy the getting there, but not quite period costuming and set decoration that was there. The episode starts with an FBI office break-in. And then during the flashbacks, it's like exactly the same office, except there's just typewriters instead of computers.
Except there's like a phone with a bell in it.
Exactly, yeah. Like the sign is still the same somehow, and it's like just as bright on day one as it was day 2024.
Mm-hmm.
I did enjoy this one, and I have to say, I learned a lot about D.B. Cooper through this episode, just because as a child, I never understood what it was. You heard it a lot in the 70s. D.B. Cooper, like, I lump it in with Quicksand, Killer Bees, tarantulas that will eat you in your sleep, and these weird 70s cultural moments that happened and seemed to pass very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a Dan Aykroyd movie, too? Was it about D.B. Cooper, or was that Dr. Detroit?
There's a Treat Williams movie.
Treat Williams is
one. Yeah, Treat Williams.
Thank you.
He plays him.
So I was not really super familiar with the details of the D.B. Cooper case. I had no idea it was Dan Cooper until they told me here. So thanks, Exposition Fairy. This was a good one to start out on of the three that we're going to be talking about today, because it actually did set a lot of the goalposts in the case for me personally. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's kind of a fascinating case. Like, judging by just like the facts outside of what Leverage did to spin it, I'm kind of sad that he probably just like hit a tree, died, and some bear ate him or something.
Yeah,
you know, the money's
totally
just around. Because it feels like there should have been a way better ending. And like, time is running out for this guy to pop out in culture and say, it was me, ha ha ha. And he fans out all his money, then dies.
Yeah.
Like, that's the way to go out, right? But I don't feel like we're going to get that end to the story. But this one was a pretty good substitute, I thought.
Yeah. Even if it only was a like fifth season ennui fighting concept episode sop to someone in the cast or in the writer's room, or whatever, we want to see Aldous Hodge with giant sideburns. Like, okay, like whatever it takes to get him into some flares, I'm not mad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to tell you to pay for it, but I think it's on freebie, so you don't have to pay for it. And it clearly came from this place of loving the case and being like kind of proud that they'd come up with this solution, but also not taking it quite as just deadly boring seriously as some nonfiction properties take it. I thought this was the perfect balance and a surprise for this show. So I'm glad you guys liked it too.
Yep.
Well, there's a little lighter amount of D.B. Cooper content in our next episode, but not none. I'm going to be telling everybody about Prison Break Season 1, Episode 11, titled And Then There Were Seven. The Leverage D.B. Cooper episode aired nowhere near the actual anniversary. It aired in August. This and the next one both were in November, so right in the D.B. Cooper corridor. That's what we'll be calling the pre-Thanksgiving days
the
now
Coupador.
Instead of that.
Yes.
So in the aughts, Fox committed to hyper-serialized storytelling with 24, and a few years into that show's hugely successful run, and 1 year post-Lost, another big serial storytelling experiment of the era, Fox tried to go back to the well with Prison Break. It worked for longer than you probably remember, which is four seasons, a movie, and a revival 8 years later, but it did not work as well as 24 for a lot of reasons that I think were apparent in this episode. So the premise is that Lincoln Burrows, badly played by Dominic Purcell, has been wrongly convicted of murder and sentenced to death. His brother, Michael Scofield, also not very well played by Wentworth Miller, comes up with an astonishingly complex plan to break him out involving a bunch of different elements, starting with Michael himself also getting convicted of a crime and sentenced to the same prison. Other than that, the element most people remember, if they remember the show at all, is a map of the prison's, like, guts, essentially, artfully tattooed all over Michael's torso. So each episode introduces another piece of the plan. In this one, Michael's green card wife, Nika, comes for a conjugal visit to hand off a credit card, but it's not a credit card. It's a key card for the prison security system. So Michael can let himself into the storage room with everyone's personal effects and get back his gold watch, but the watch isn't there because a guard stole it. So he has to ask Tweener, Charles Westmoreland's new cellmate, to lift it off the guy. And unfortunately, this involves talking to Tweener, and it sounds like this, clip one.
Oh, God.
Inside these walls, I creep and I crawl, looking for a way out. But I know this gonna be no easy route. This is gonna be a 12-round bout. With Bellican tea bag on my mind, and it's grinding here.
Still interested in getting in on PI?
Does my mama got big breastises?
I wouldn't know.
Hell yeah, she does. And hell yeah, I do.
Okay, that's enough. So, Dave, I'm going to throw it to you to tell us what you said in this scene about this guy.
I just thought maybe David Silver went to prison for some reason.
Oh, God.
It really had some David Silver energy going on there.
Really did.
I felt like this was a sentence for us.
Yeah. My favorite part of that clip was... Yes, you speak for all of us.
So
that's every time that guy's on screen, it's cringeworthy like that.
Completely.
And sometimes he's not rapping; he's just talking.
Yes,
and it's like, yeah. Please
or
stop.
Coded in his own vom. Thanks, Fox.
Ship him.
So Tweener fakes a medical emergency. That's where he's coded in his own vom to get close to the guard. And Michael attaches the watch to a tape recorder and buries it under some sod and uses it to determine the timing of the guard's rounds in the yard. And we're supposed to think that to make a point, Michael forces his cellmate Sucre to listen to 20 minutes of silence to prove he knows what he's talking about, I guess. It's like Sucre is already in the process of digging a hole for Michael's whole crew to escape from. I think he's on board with everything that you have already told him. But speaking of the hole, there's also some bullshit with Teabag, the sex offender on the crew, also being super racist to the people of color who are in this escape crew. But since A, the show really thought it was doing something a lot edgier with this than it was, and B, apparently Robert Knepper, who played Teabag, is allegedly a sex offender for real. We're just gonna skim over that. Michael also has a crush on the prison doctor, Sarah, played, guess what, badly by Sarah Wayne Callies. If anyone remembers two things about this show, the second thing is that their scenes have negative chemistry. They're like two magnets pushed the wrong way. They're so bad. Outside of the prison, there's yet another plot line involving the brother's longtime friend, Veronica, played by Robin Tunney, Lincoln's son, LJ, and a third guy played by Frank Grillo. He's probably got a name, doesn't matter. They are investigating the conspiracy that led to Lincoln's incarceration, which an FBI agent played by Michael Gaston is very determined to stop them doing, but then he overplays his hand and falls down a well, and the guys he calls to help him just leave him there, and I don't know whose side I'm supposed to be on. I also don't care. Moving on. Everything Michael Gaston has ever done in his career has led to him being left in a hole to die, honestly.
I think I think one of the guys who leaves him down there is played either by Jeremy Bob from The Loop in
It's Paul Russian Adelstein.
Doll or though the other one, but I always conflate these two guys.
Oh, it's not Jeremy Bob, but I know. Yeah, the other guy. I don't know.
Yeah,
guy.
It's like it's like full of "Hey, it's that guys" that are hateful sometimes because I first saw them on this. Like Knepper is totally that guy that now I'm just like, ugh, Teabag.
Yes, totally. How does DB Cooper fit into this narrative, you might ask? Well, episodes prior to this have already established that Charles Westmoreland, Tweener's cellmate, as previously mentioned, is believed by other inmates to be D.B. Cooper, but he has denied it to Michael and consistently denied it to everybody else. However, things have changed for Westmoreland in that his daughter is dying and he's been denied a compassionate furlough to see her before her funeral. So when Tweener gives Westmoreland the watch to return to Michael, Westmoreland lets Michael know he's interested in joining the crew. Clip two.
Don't take this the wrong way, but everyone who's in is bringing something to the table.
How about money?
How much are we talking about?
I think you know.
I seem to remember several conversations that ended with, I am not D.B. Cooper.
I lied.
You lied.
We're cons. We tend to do that.
I checked your alibi. According to records, you were incarcerated at the time of the Cooper hijacking.
My father and I share more than just a weakness for easy money. We also share a name. Charles Westmoreland Sr. was the one locked up that day. Now, do you want the money or not?
No offense, but it's a little convenient. You want in, and suddenly you're the guy. How do I know you're not lying right now?
Hey, old man River, keep him moving.
Just to backtrack briefly, the other guy Sarah was trying to remember is Danny McCarthy. He's the other FBI law enforcement dude. So later, Westmoreland and Michael meet up in the chapel. Clip three.
Dorothy Andrews Elston Kebbis, United States Treasurer, 1971, the year of the D.B. Cooper hijacking. DI-192589. The first number in a series of bills used in the ransom drop.
Thanks for the history lesson. All it proves is you did the research. Same as me.
Wrong, because Westmoreland then gives Michael a Bible with a bill in it, and oh my God, it's super old and has a serial number that proves it's from the ransom money.
It's not that old, though. Nice and new and crisp, and it's from the wrong bill series. And you know who cares about this? D.B. Cooper case hits.
Yeah, it definitely looked like the type of bill that had been in prison for a long time. One thing about prison that I know is nothing's folded and put in pockets or anything like that when you're trying to keep it from guards.
They don't even have pockets.
I mean,
that is your armpit.
When Sarah was saying she pulled threads and it held up, I mean, this is the opposite of the prison break story. Like, that's so stupid. The show is so dumb and preposterous.
I don't think I've seen an episode of this show before. It is. Anyways, please continue. But
I hung in with it because of this, and boy, yeah. I'll never get that time back. Mm-hmm. I'm not happy.
So it's probably overstating things to say the Charles Westmoreland is D.B. Cooper idea is the show's only good idea, but it does feel like that based on this episode. I think we may have watched the pilot together, Dave, and then we're like, this seems dumb, and then we were right. But many years after this, Orange is the New Black would cut back and forth between characters' backstories and their current incarcerations. Here, literally none of the characters is interesting at all, including like the two brothers in the lead. Westmoreland is the only one who comes close. He's played by Muse Watson. And that's the other issue. I mean, just to backtrack again, I cannot overstate how terrible both Wentworth Miller and Dominic Purcell are. And seeing them here, like, I can't believe they were cast to play brothers again in Legends of Tomorrow. Like, who was that for? Like, what a weird Easter egg.
They were sort of good in that because they were being this, but like making fun of it. So it was funny.
Right.
But who were their parents? Like, it was the mom and the father was like a bad vertical hold. Like, these guys don't look anything alike.
No, the father was the in a world where guy that is just like, okay, that's the only tone they have.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that one guy's pretty to look at, and that's why he's there. But
he's cute, for sure.
He's not bringing anything to the table acting-wise, for sure.
No.
Nope.
The other issue is clearly someone really wanted another 24, but at a certain point, the intricate plotting just gets ridiculous. The proof that they had no endgame is season three is about them breaking out of a different prison. So this is a movie. Wow. This is not a TV show that you hope will go on forever. This idea is a movie-sized idea, and I do think if the show had been made 10 years later, it would just be an anthology series where every season it's a different prison break, probably. Mm. And that's like a more successful idea for this.
And D.B. Cooper's in all of them.
Sure.
When they went to the second prison.
Yeah.
Did he have to get re-tattooed? Did he get tattooed on a different, like, where his legs now? How'd they work that?
Because
it seems to me like the characters' fatal flaw is he can't just think about the maps. He has to have them on his skin.
Yes.
Therefore, I'm worried about his chances of getting out of the second prison without a tattoo of the floor plan.
Right. Well, my joke answer is like, whenever I see an actor with a really distinctive tattoo, I'm like, why would you do this if you want to be an actor? Like, this cuts out a whole range of kinds of parts you can play.
Yeah.
But in all seriousness, I don't think the incarceration in the second prison is part of a plan. And that has to be, they have to figure things out on a fly. So I guess that part is different, but whatever. Please don't tell me. I don't care about the show.
Did they break out of the second prison and just immediately go back into the first prison? Not realizing that they had reached their goal of getting out. And they're like, well, we got to get back to the first prison to complete our plan.
They're like,
and they get into the first prison. And they're like, in the middle of the night, it's like, ah!
Yes.
Shit.
They're like Brooks and Shawshank, where they're just institutionalized, where they let them out, and they're like, we don't know what to do now. Anyway, to get back to the D.B. Cooper of it all, to wrap it up, Muse Watson is so much more charismatic than everyone else, including Stacey Keach, who plays the warden who tells him about his daughter dying. Like, to make him also D.B. Cooper seems like overkill in terms of watchability for this character personally. And if D.B. Cooper's going to do anything with the skyjacking money, it might as well be bankroll a scheme that seems preposterous but just might work, because, as we know, that's his thing. But that's everything I have to say about this episode of Prison Break. What a bad show! How did it ever get a revival? Never mind three more seasons. It's very shitty.
I mean, to anyone who is ever sort of nostalgic for the 22 episode model, like, especially with a show like this, where I think this is right after they got the pickup for the whole season.
Yeah.
So then they're really like stretch. Making the stretch motion like to each other in the writer's room instead of writing anything. And also you're stuck with this cast.
Yeah.
Except that Muse Watson, like, don't watch this, so spoilers aho, I guess. Mm-hmm. This character gets killed and is only seen in flashback in future seasons. The other problem is, like, to sort of tantalize you with the idea that this could be D.B. Cooper, like, that was fine up to a point. But, like, if D.B. Cooper had never been heard from because he had been locked up for some other shit, he absolutely would have used it to bargain to get out of it, because this was a notorious unsolved case. So like a fictional D.B. Cooper just being like, I deny being D.B. Cooper, like, you don't want out of this pit.
Yeah.
You don't want to go to like Lewisburg, where you get to go out in the yard every time you want and have a garden plot. Okay. Sure. Deebs.
What
whatever.
If they recontextualized D.B. Cooper's case so it took place in the Prison Break modern day? And the way he's inserted into the proceedings is that when he jumps out of the plane, fucks it all up, he lands in the prison yard with the green duffel bag, and that's the money they can take with them to survive on the outside. So it's total coincidence that it all came together.
That sounds like Prison Break : The Challenge, your new reality show.
Or it's like the Poe toaster, where it's just like a whole bunch of different guys. And like this generation's D.B. Cooper has been detailed to get the Fox River 12 or what, however many they ended up with out of Fox River. Sure.
There's a family, the Coopers, out there. And the firstborn of every generation is destined to jump out of a plane with money.
Yeah.
And what happens there is up to
really, it's like Slayers.
Yeah.
Got it. Let's get back to safe ground with stuff that's actually watchable. Here's my unscripted roundup. I will keep it brief. All of this will be linked in the show notes. These are some IRL properties that are worth watching. I was going to do a worst of list, but like, it's kind of all of them. Like, History's Greatest Mysteries, like Lawrence Fishburne stalking around in front of a scale model of a plane. I've watched them all. It won't be good. If I didn't mention it here, probably don't bother, but you can at me if you want. We can talk about it on the Discord. All right. Unscripted recommendation number one, I Am D.B. Cooper. It is a little bit amateurish, but it does have a let's try it this way storytelling style that I enjoyed. At least it's confident and trying to do something different. I was surprised that you could find that on Amazon Prime, but you actually can. I saw it when it was doing the festival circuit last year, and it is a little like, let's make a movie, but there's some actually laugh-out-loud funny bits in it. I enjoyed it. Next up, The Mystery of D.B. Cooper. That is also on Amazon Prime. It had excellent access to case figures. It didn't try to do too much with laughable, you can't disprove a negative speculation about how it was obviously Don Draper. And what's key to these things, it doesn't take itself too seriously. Number three, D.B. Cooper, Where Are You in Tarot Bang? Here's where I complain that going forward, D.B. Cooper material really needs to start thinking way outside of this box with the titling conventions. It is always some variation on where are you, where is he, the hunt for, the search for, case closed, case reopened, the complete file, who is D.B., I am D.B., I understand what SEO is, but for fuck's sake, my kingdom for an I was a teenage D.B. Cooper or everybody loves D.B. Cooper.
Y'all
how about
see
Beyond
D.B.
the
Cooper?
Valley? Oh my God, anything, seriously. Bride of Inglorious D.B. Cooper's, whatever. Ready Cooper One. Help us help you. So, D.B. Cooper, where are you? Interrobang, is more concerned than most with the meta aspects of the case, like why we're so into it versus the case itself, what it says about American culture at the time that it happened, the paranoia and distrust of government in the 70s, versus now when you have politicized conspiracy theories and like libertarians going to CooperCon, the true crime industrial complex, blah, blah, blah. That one was probably one episode too long, but it's thoughtfully made. It's well made. You won't regret it. That one is on Netflix. And finally, let's go back to the classics, shall we? Unsolved Mysteries, famous original Stackisodes, Season 1, Episode 5. It is no surprise that the show got to DB very promptly in its first season, nor that a longer than usual portion of the episode is devoted to it instead of ghosts or reunited twins. This one is worthwhile just to see how people were thinking about the case in the late 80s when less than two decades had passed versus more than five. Also, Robert Stack walking around a set in his trench coat. You can't beat it. That is on Freevee. Thank you for your time.
Woo!
It is time for our final D.B. Cooper episode, because I'm going to talk about a three-part D.B. Cooper epic on news radio from season 5, episodes 6, 7, and 8. That is Jail, The Lamb, and Clash of the Titans.
A D.B. Coop arc, if you will.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Tara.
You're welcome.
All right. Let's get into it with Jail, our first episode, which we will be concentrating on today. At the WNYX staff meeting, Matthew, that is the office's village idiot, or the village's office idiot, has a story idea. Joe knows the details. Jimmy James's admin is a bad idea, and Dave doesn't care.
Anybody else have any story ideas?
Me. 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 Me.
Oh, Matthew.
Thank you. Well, my sources say that the FBI is close to making an arrest in that D.B. Cooper case.
Matthew, would your sources by any chance be today's New York Post?
Lisa, a reporter never reveals his sources.
Do you even know who D.B. Cooper is?
Yeah, he's the,
On November 24th, 1971, a man calling himself D.B. Cooper hijacked a plane and ransomed it for $200,000, then successfully parachuted away with the loot, never to be seen or heard from again.
And some people think he survived the jump and lived happily ever after.
No way. D.B. Cooper parachuted to his death. End of story.
Dave, I'd like to interject something here.
Oh, of course, sir.
I don't think this story shows much promise.
Yeah, well, I actually have no intention of doing a story on
Dave,
D.B. Cooper,
I don't want to tell you how to do your job. I'm just saying, D.B. Cooper, who cares?
Yeah, once again, sir, I agree with you.
So, for one, if you don't mind, would like to say that there's no way that the station should be doing a story on D.B. Cooper.
Well, obviously, there's no way I'm going to win this one, sir. So, I'm sorry, everyone. We're not going to do a story on D.B. Cooper. The meeting is now adjourned.
All right, Jimmy James.
Oh, shoot.
You are under arrest for violation of federal interstate hijacking laws.
All right. What the hell is this all about?
Huh? All these guys think I'm D.B. Cooper, so.
And so the stage is set for the D.B. Cooper episodes of News Radio, where Jimmy James is accused of being none other than D.B. Cooper. Later, Dave Foley's character, the station manager, visits Jimmy in what Jimmy thinks is Gattaca prison. Dave is freaked out about the whole situation, but Jimmy James is playing it cool. He tells Dave that the corporation, Jimmy James Corporation, is going to send legal help, but at any rate, the FBI has no case unless...
Yeah, I mean, the government's case against me is nothing but circumstantial evidence.
Absolutely.
There's not one shred of hard evidence against
me. None exists.
Exactly. Unless they find that green duffel bag that the money was carried away in. I mean, then I'd be worried, yeah, but, you know, as it is.
Why would it worry you if, you know, if they were to find this green duffel bag that you're talking about? Why would that worry you?
No reason.
So you have to remember at this point, Jimmy James' eccentricities have been enumerated in these series at large. He's run for president. He's a billionaire ballooner. So this sort of like tracks, but it's like the most outrageous of them all here in season five. So back at the radio station, everyone is doing their part to help Jimmy. Joe and Beth are practicing busting him out of prison using the station air ducts as a dry run. Lisa has brought in her bad boy juvie shiv for Jimmy to use in prison. And Lisa's also working the case for a story to exonerate Jimmy. But it all works against him, all the data that Lisa has collected. So Dave puts Matthew on the story because he'll definitely do a terrible job of it. Then enter season five's Saving Grace. This is the season after Phil Hartman has died. Just by nature, a weaker season. But the saving grace for season five is Johnny Johnson, exec VP operations, played by Patrick Warburton, who you know, who played Putty on Seinfeld. He is fantastic. He is one of the rare but super enjoyable breeds of characters we call the happy villain here, which is a joyously evil character. And this guy absolutely nails it. Here is Johnny Johnson.
So the rest of the staff pretty stressed out?
Yeah, pretty much.
And I guess it's up to us to cheer him up. Let's roll, partner.
Listen up, everybody.
My name is Johnny Johnson. I work for Jimmy, too, and I'm here to help you guys out during this crisis.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Well, when is Mr. James coming back? Is he coming back soon?
Well, you know, it's...
I see you're holding a stopwatch.
Yeah.
Now, can that thing measure a New York minute? Because Jimmy could be coming through that door any minute. This is New York City. I think the best thing we could do for him is to, keep this operation running at peak efficiency until he gets back. Don't you think that's right, Dave?
Well, I
know it, pal.
Back at Gattaca Prison, Matthew is on the beat, and he is working the D.B. Cooper story, interviewing Jimmy in his cell.
Okay, the kid gloves are off.
Okie doke, you just fire away, Mike Wallace.
No, Matthew.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, let me get right to the question.
All right.
That's on everybody's mind. Mr. James, are you Doobie Keebler?
Matthew also delivers the news about Johnny Johnson coming to the office, and Jimmy freaks the hell out. It is not good news for Jimmy. They are old rivals. At the station, Johnny puts Lisa back on the D.B. Cooper case to Dave's chagrin, and then Matthew relays a day-old message from Jimmy James about Johnny.
I forgot to tell you something really important that Mr. James told me about Johnny Johnson yesterday.
All right, what is it?
Okay, I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget.
Yeah. Come on, what is it?
He's evil and must be stopped at all costs.
Well, I just assume you're misquoting him, all right?
No, actually, he wrote this down.
What?
See, that's not my handwriting.
Matthew, why didn't you tell me about this earlier?
Kind of busy, Dave. You're the one that assigned me the Dobie Gillis story.
At this point, everybody in the office beside Dave come under Johnny Johnson's spell, as the happy villain always does to people near him. The security guards that Dave finally tells to kick Johnny out, leave his office, best of buddies. Matthew and Beth love him now. Max, who's a total sycophant, is there. Lisa decides to have drinks with him tonight because she needs to do research. Everybody loves Johnny Johnson at the office. Dave confronts Johnny, who apparently has the green duffel bag, as a special bulletin goes out on the air to report Jimmy has escaped from prison.
Everything's going to be okay, right, Johnny?
All we can do is hope and pray that Jimmy knows what he's doing, if you'll excuse me.
There. Do you hear that? Huh? Do you hear that?
What, Dave? The sound of Johnny weeping?
He's not weeping, he's laughing. Maniacally.
Tara, you notice a weird little prop problem with Lisa doing the report over the air?
Yeah, she's holding a pencil, but it's not sharpened. Yeah. Like, it just is still completely flat at the end.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
And our first setup episode ends with Joe breaking into the prison far too late. Jimmy has already escaped. And that's how our first episode ends. And then we have our second episode, which is The Lamb, which has the least amount of D.B. Cooper content. So I'm just going to do highlights from this episode till we get to the conclusion of D.B. content in the next one. Johnny Johnson as a happy villain is fantastic. He has so many great lines where, while he's doing all his machinations and he's positioning himself to take over the corporation to leave Jimmy James in prison, we get lines like this against Dave at the office when he's talking to Biff.
Dave, when are you going to stop sending a sharp tongue to do a hug's work? Hey.
Reminds me of the Cable Town guy from 30 Rock as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. a lot of hug energy. Mm-hmm. Here is a clip with Johnny and Max.
Hey, shine your shoes, boss.
You just shined them, champ.
Yeah, but that was before you walked them over here.
This guy.
You lose something with not being able to see it, but he just like wraps his arm all the way around Max's shoulders, like makes a funny face, points, this guy.
Yeah. But with the appropriate 2-second pregnant pause before, so you can really sell the motion after.
Yeah.
Is fantastic.
Delightful.
There's a call from Dave's mom. Jimmy James has managed to get to Dave's parents' house, which is an ongoing thing in the show. Jimmy James has never met Dave's mom, I believe, up until this point, but has a weird crush on her.
He's obsessed with her, yeah.
Just from the photo on Dave's desk. He ended up there. That's where he's hiding out. Meanwhile, Johnny proposes to Lisa. There's a weird, risky business moment with Jimmy James at Dave's mom's parent house, which is just like thrown out there. It's so stupid, but it totally works. Stephen Root doing Tom Cruise in Risky Business. Sure. Mm-hmm. Why the hell not?
Yeah.
And exactly. We also get Johnny laying out his plans in this episode.
All right, Dave, I'm going to be honest with you. Nobody believes a word you say anyway. I'm evil. Away for a long time. And, yes, I came here with the sole purpose of stealing Jimmy's empire. But all that changed the moment I laid eyes on Lisa.
Oh, come on. You can't just turn off your evilosity.
The word is evilness, Dave. Yeah, I can't. I happen to have a talent for evil. Doesn't mean I like it.
Well, then why do it?
Well, it fills that void within me, the void that Lisa fills. I'm a hollow man, Dave. I'm like a cheap chocolate Easter bunny.
So Dave then tries to get Lisa to marry him, despite his past objections. But eventually she turns Johnny down, who then goes ballistic and sets up Dave as the Turner inner of the duffel bag to the FBI, who then arrests Jimmy James at Dave's parents' place. And that is the end of the second episode. Our conclusion is season 5, episode 8, Clash of the Titans. And weirdly, the D.B. Cooper part wraps up real quick in this episode. Most of the story is a battle of business wills between Jimmy James and Johnny Johnson after the fact. But at the start of the episode, the whole gang at the station is clued in to the true nature of Johnny Johnson.
Why are you celebrating, boss? Mr. James is going to jail.
You want to take this one, Dave?
All right. Johnny wants Mr. James to go to jail. It's all part of his evil plan. You know the evil plan I've been warning you about for weeks?
Bingo.
I love happy villains.
Yeah.
Happy villains are great.
Mm-hmm.
And then at Jimmy James' court appearance, we get the out of the blue true truth about D.B. Cooper.
The story is as follows. I was camping, you know, all alone, by myself, just trying to get my head straight, enjoying some freeze-dried turkey loaf in God's country when boom, this guy comes parachuting out of the sky, lands on my pup tent, and asks me to give him a lift into town.
So you just gave this guy a ride?
Yeah, wait, can you believe it after he trashed my tent? Oh, he seemed cool, so after I dropped him off, I noticed that he left his duffel bag in the back of my van, and it was empty.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, this is a very convenient alibi that you've concocted here, Mr. James.
Thank you.
Yes, and I suppose now that you're going to tell the court you have no idea who this mysterious stranger was or where he could be located today.
Well, yeah, I know who it was. It was Adam West.
Adam West?
Yeah.
Batman.
That's one.
No, Adam West is not D.B. Cooper.
I'm afraid I was, Your Honor.
That's it. That's how they end that. Yeah. I don't know whether they had a whole like season-long arc prepared for D.B. Cooper and then something changed. They got a cancellation notice or something. I don't know. Or maybe it was always just going to be Batman's Adam West was D.B. Cooper, and that's the reveal. And that is literally the last moment we hear about D.B. Cooper in this episode.
Yeah.
They're done. Jimmy James gets his corporation back, but not really. And then there's like basically just sort of like a bet between the two powers, and Jimmy James sort of lucks out and gets the better of Johnny in a, like, you can take one employee with you. You're the one employee! And then he has to, like, leave the company because of, you know, honor among thieves, I guess.
Yes.
There's
being evil is
no excuse for poor sportsmanship.
Exactly, yes. So that is the D.B. Cooper theory as presented by News Radio.
Yeah.
Delightful. The highlight of the last season of News Radio, for sure. Johnny Johnson comes back as a broken man later in the series, and it's pretty great again.
Yep.
As he makes a second run at taking over all the affairs at WNYX. But what did you guys think of this episode?
I really enjoyed it. As D.B. Cooper content, it was both like, what? But it was also perfect. Like, yep. I think the key with this, especially at this point, is like, an out there theory like this that is like surreal, but like just weird enough that it could be true. Like, sure, Adam West was D.B. Cooper. Why the fuck not? It makes as much sense or more sense than a lot of like serious theories. So, sure.
Yeah.
You know, do I have a quibble with how old the duffel bag looked? Meaning not very. Yeah. They got it at the East Hanover Target the day before they shot it. Yeah. But the spirit of this, like, if you're going to include D.B. Cooper in a sort of larger story and send it up like this, you have to have it down also. And they really do. They clearly had a ton of fun with it. And I think that's what you need to do in scripted versions. Just not take it too seriously and be one of those people that's like, I hired an independent DNA lab to test this, like, sheet corner. Like, okay, just... Like, everybody who claims he died, they're probably right. But this, I like this. He crashed into his pup tent? Sure. But I also would have believed that Jimmy James was D.B. Cooper based on the universe of the show.
Yes, thank you. Because I realize we can't know anything that's not in evidence on screen, but I have always watched this suite of episodes thinking, Jimmy James is D.B. Cooper, and he just paid off Adam West to say that it was him, because when you're a billionaire, you could do that.
Yeah.
Like, we don't know anything about Jimmy James's background, really. We know he's from Florida. We know he made his money after starting his own brokerage house. But, like, from that, you know, from humble beginnings to here, I mean, it would have been helpful to have a few $100,000 of seed money that you stole off a plane, you know? So I obviously love these episodes. Dave knows that I do. I think watching them this time with a more critical eye, I would say probably the second two could have been collapsed into one.
Yeah.
There's a lot of repetition of like Dave being like, he's evil. And no one believes Dave. Like, there's just that scene happens a bunch.
Yeah, it's true.
But the first episode, I think, is especially for the, you know, the post Phil Hartman years, is like actually one of the best episodes of the series, just because the characterization of Johnny Johnson is so assured. The joyful villain is a type, the happy villain. This is probably the best one. I know we have a Mark One episode where we ran down a whole bunch of different ones from television, like Chris Traeger from Parks and Recreation, the mayor from Buffy, etc. But Johnny is like truly the best one. Like, he's so funny. So happy that you kind of can't really be that mad about how evil he is, even though he's doing evil things to characters that you love.
But then you also get like that second half of the season story where you don't usually get with a happy villain, which is the happy villain builds himself up again, which is unique to his character. So that's a bonus for Johnny Johnson.
Yes. if you want to see what it's like when Patrick Warburton asks for a quarter a bunch.
Yeah.
That's what you see in those later episodes.
Well, since you were nitpicky, let me do a nitpick of my own, which was in the courtroom. Why didn't Jimmy James invoke Tubal-Cain again?
Yes. Yes.
In an earlier episode, I think season two or three, we established that in a courtroom, because all judges are Freemasons. You can say Tubal-Cain, the Bible's first stonemason, and they will do some weird thing and then award the case to you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be a rock solid law in news radio land, but
that's
did not invoke it again. So.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
Maybe that's only for civil cases.
Perhaps.
Tubal-Cain.
Nice.
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We hijacked 1 hour of your time to discuss three very different portrayals of D.B. Cooper from Leverage, Prison Break, and News Radio. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
you're not going to show bitch at me again, are you?
And Sarah D. Bunting.
Ow.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Dave, I don't want to tell you how to do your job. I'm just saying, D.B. Cooper, who cares?